We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge and we're glad to have you with us. Last month, the Obama administration announced changes designed to make it easier for veterans, military veterans, suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder to get help. Under these new rules, veterans will no longer have to cite a specific event as the cause of the PTSD and prove that it in fact happened. They'll only have to have a diagnosis and show that their PTSD was related to their military service. A lot of people think that this is a good thing, a step in the right direction, but still have concerns about how it is we think about it, how it is we talk about it, and how it is the VA deals with it. This morning, in this hour, we'll try to talk a little bit about post-traumatic stress disorder, what it is, how it's diagnosed, and how it's treated. And our guest for the program is John L. High. He is assistant professor in the University of Toledo's Department of Psychology. That's in Toledo, Ohio, where he directs their post-traumatic stress disorder lab. He does research on psychological trauma and PTSD and has done a lot of writing on the subject. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are welcome. We do hope people will indeed keep it to a question. We'll try to be brief. We'll be on the topic, and that will help us make the best use of the time and get in as many callers as we can. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that, and that is 800-222-9455. Also, you can send us your comments by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. That's the address. And Dr. L. High, hello.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. I think probably it would be a good idea simply to start with a definition. What is post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, is a mental disorder. Specifically, it's classified as an anxiety disorder. It basically requires that the patient was involved in a catastrophic or tragic traumatic event, something that basically threatens life or serious injury. And it basically involves satisfying several symptom criteria that essentially involve having difficulty getting over the traumatic event. So we're talking about things like reliving the trauma, having flashbacks of it, for example, and really going out of your way to avoid dealing with the trauma, not wanting to talk about it or being reminded of it, and also being very much on edge, fearing that another similar traumatic event might happen to you. And that's essentially at its core what PTSD is.
And this, it's something that we talk about a lot in connection with combat, with people who have been in the military. But the stressor event, the catastrophic event, could be a number of different things. So it wouldn't necessarily have to be combat. It could be a car accident. Could be being a victim of a serious crime. It could be all kinds of things.
Exactly. Civilian or military-related traumas would count.
Mm. Is this something where making the diagnosis is something of a judgment call? So if we had, for example, one individual who we thought maybe had PTSD and we had several psychologists each interview that person, would it be likely that we would get a number of different diagnoses?
Well, to some extent, that is true. In other aspects, you know, you do have some consistency. So we do have, in the mental health field, we have our diagnostic and statistical manual of mental disorders. So we do have very precise criteria for PTSD, for both what type of trauma would count and also for what the symptoms have to look like. So in really severe cases, you'd have pretty high consistency across mental health professionals. It's really the black and white cases that that, you know, you have consistency, but in the gray area cases, that's where the problems lie. So, you know, anybody would allow a traumatic event like combat exposure or a violent rape to be a trauma that could count in, you know, assessing the diagnosis. But gray area cases are where psychologists and other mental health professionals disagree, where it's not so clear-cut what the trauma is, or it's not so clear-cut how severe or how frequent the symptoms are.
Hmm. What's the number now of veterans, and let's just say, let's just confine ourselves to the recent Iraq War and Afghanistan, and not go back further than that, but if we say that set, that subset of veterans, how many people have been diagnosed with PTSD?
Well, for the recent wars, you know, the problem is that the prevalence rates vary quite a bit. You know, we're looking at a range of somewhere about 4% to as high as about 17% or so, because the studies do find, you know, varying rates.
Hmm. How, I guess that confuses me, but again, perhaps indeed it goes back to your response to the last question about the difficulty of diagnosis. I would think, though, that there would be an official number, the number that you would get from the VA, and then perhaps if you asked other people, you would get other kinds of numbers.
Well, I mean, there are basically a lot of different large-scale studies in the U.S. and also other countries from the recent conflicts. Each study uses slightly different methodologies, slightly different ways to measure PTSD, and so that's where the confusion lies. Mm-hmm. So there is really no single one prevalence rate. You know, probably the better studies would probably show something more along the rates of about 10%, roughly. But it is tricky because of the different definitions and the different ways that the studies are conducted.
Right. Well, I guess I certainly was thinking primarily of American veterans, but this is something that I want to get back to maybe a little bit later on in the conversation. It is the case that rates of PTSD vary from soldiers of one country to another. And one of the questions that I know people have raised about this, if they said, say, just for example, let's compare American soldiers to soldiers from the UK. Well, our rates are much higher than theirs. And a lot of people have raised this question, well, why is that?
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, so I don't know if you want to get into that now.
Well, maybe I should. I opened that up initially saying let's save it. I'm saying maybe we should save that. Let me come to another question that it is. So we say maybe the rates of PTSD are around 10%, and we talked about the difficulties of making a diagnosis. Do you think, and do people in this field think, that there are significant numbers of soldiers that we have missed, or at least who have PTSD and have not been officially diagnosed?
Yes. I mean, I think we're dealing with two problems. One is we're dealing with a lot of veterans who are unwilling to come forward and get treatment. There's still, in this country and in many other countries, in both the military and in civilian communities, a stigma of coming forward and claiming that you have a mental health problem, wanting to go for mental health treatment. So there are a lot of suffering veterans who are not diagnosed yet because they haven't gotten help. We also have the opposite problem. We also have probably a minority of people who are, they have incentives to fabricate PTSD. They have incentives, monetary incentives from the VA to get disability payments for PTSD that it's possible they may not have. So we're missing veterans, and we probably have some inflation on the other hand too.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's come to this this recent change. This, I think, was part of our reason for wanting to discuss the topic, to talk about the change in the rules. Maybe the way to do it is to say, well, what were the rules before?
Well, the rules before were basically, if a veteran wanted to come forward and file a disability claim for PTSD to get disability payments for the disorder, they had to basically go through the VA's bureaucracy, go through the disability claims process, they'd have to have supporting documents to claim that they were in the places where they said that they were, and that, you know, that basically they suffered traumatic events that would support PTSD diagnosis. Mm-hmm. It was a complicated process. Veterans I've spoken with said that, you know, many months would go by, they wouldn't hear anything, they'd have to go back and refile, reclaim things. So now there's a more streamlined process that's proposed, but one of the changes that you alluded to is that certain types of veterans do not have to show documentation that they suffered a traumatic event in the military. Rather, their own testimony or a doctor's diagnosis would suffice.
Yeah, it seems like the big difference is that before, the burden of proof was on the vet. The person, the individual, had to say, this happened to me, it happened on this day, it happened in this place at this time, and I can prove to you that I was there and that this happened. And that now what we're talking about before is now is maybe an acknowledgement that that just being there, that being in the war zone, is a stressor, and you don't necessarily have to say, well, I was walking down the road one day and an IED went off right next to me, to be able to make the claim that you're suffering from PTSD.
Right, right.
Well, so then I guess the question is this a good thing, and does this truly make it easier for people with PTSD to get help?
Right, right. And I think people are, I think it's ultimately going to be a mixed bag. On the one hand, it's going to decrease the problems with the VA's bureaucracy, which is, you know, the VA is very large. It's the largest closed system of public health in the country. So it's going to help streamline things. I think the problem that some in the mental health field are talking about is that there are certainly soldiers overseas in places like Iraq and Afghanistan who never see any combat and who really are not going to encounter traumatic events. They're stationed in very large military bases that are highly secured, and they're not, you know, just like in Vietnam and in other war eras, there are veteran soldiers who they don't see any combat. So it is possible that you could have a veteran who claims PTSD and without having to have any corroboration of evidence that they saw a trauma, it's possible that they could say that they had a trauma that happened to them, but it really didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. I guess, though, the other side of that is people are arguing that there are some people who might legitimately be suffering from PTSD who were not directly in combat, but, for example, if you were a nurse and you were dealing with a lot of people who are terribly wounded, you could have PTSD as a result. Or maybe if you were somebody like whose job was you drove a truck, well, you could be driving down the road and an IED could go off and blow up your truck. So that's always a real possibility. So you're exposed to these stressors. Maybe you're not necessarily in combat. You're not walking down the street with a gun. You're not in firefights. But that it's still possible for you to have PTSD.
Right, certainly. Or even someone who's on some rest and relaxation in Iraq, for example, and they're raped. You know, that would be another example of, or a military training accident. Mm. So for those kinds of people, yes, this would streamline the process for them, which would otherwise be somewhat burdensome.
I'm interested in going back to this idea that this is in part an acknowledgement by the VA that just being in the war zone is a highly stressful environment. Is that, in fact, what's happening here?
It seems to be. You know, the VA uses terms of, you know, being in some sort of fear of hostile military or terrorist activity. And so, yes, they're using that term to claim that you don't have to be in an actual combat role in actual combat, but that other types of soldiers there who are not in those roles could still have that sort of ongoing fear that could traumatize them, so to speak.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus is Dr. John L. High. He's a psychologist. He's a PhD doctor. He is assistant professor at the University of Toledo in their Department of Psychology, where he directs their post-traumatic stress disorder lab. He's done a lot of research on psychological trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder, looking at things like how it is assessed, what it's all about, how it's treated. He's done a lot of writing, professional writing on the subject, and he's joining us this morning by phone. Questions, welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. You may also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. This whole business of diagnosis and whether there are people who are being diagnosed who actually don't have PTSD, or maybe there are people who have it who aren't getting the diagnosis for a variety of reasons. It's very complicated and also gets into this area where you might say, well, there no doubt are soldiers who come home who have emotional distress that's related to being in the war zone, and they have difficulties adjusting to being back home. But that may not necessarily be post-traumatic stress disorder. So some people say, maybe labeling somebody who is having distress, labeling them with PTSD, may not actually, it may not be accurate or helpful, it may even be harmful. Do you think that that's possible?
Well, what we find from even really serious traumas like combat is that most people who are involved in those situations do not develop PTSD. So you're exactly right, David, that there are lots of veterans who come back who either have no problems adjusting or they have minimal problems adjusting. That doesn't necessarily mean that they have the full-blown PTSD disorder. And so it has to be basically, you know, satisfying these criteria of that it's, you know, a trauma that would warrant the diagnosis, that the symptoms are met, and also, very importantly, that the symptoms interfere with their everyday functioning in a significant way. So if they're having occasional nightmares or they're having a rare flashback, that may not interfere with their everyday life very much, but if it's of a sufficient frequency, if the symptoms are sufficiently severe and frequent that it actually gets in the way of their ability to socialize or to work or to go to school, that's when we consider that the person is diagnosed with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that maybe leads to the question, do we need to have some more sophisticated, subtle ways of talking about this to show that there are gradations here, and it's not so much of a case of either you are or you're not, but that there could be some variety of problems that would benefit from some treatment, but that everybody's not the same.
Yeah, I agree. And that's, I think, some of the problems that some veterans face is that they go to a mental health professional and the mental health professional does not diagnose them with PTSD. Maybe the veteran even asks, do I have PTSD? And the mental health professional says, no, you don't have the full-blown disorder. But if they're just shy of meeting the disorder, they have, let's say, several symptoms that are very distressing to the person, but it's just shy of the full diagnosis. You know, that the veteran doesn't have much consolation in that. They're very disturbed by it. They don't have the diagnosis. Maybe they could still get treatment. It's just that they don't have the diagnosis. So, yes, you're right, that there is a continuum on the scale of somewhere mm-hmm. between no PTSD and having the full diagnosis.
Well, that's, I guess, the thing that would concern me, and I'm sure it would concern anybody, would be supposing that the person is having some serious issues, but for whatever reason they don't get the diagnosis of PTSD, are they still able to get help for the problems that they are having?
They could still get help. They may not be able to get help at a VA if they're a veteran. They may not be able to get help at a VA because some of the PTSD clinics at the VAs work where, you know, you have to have the full diagnosis. You know, they might be able to get help in the community. The other thing that goes along with that that's interesting is that, you know, what do you do with a veteran who had PTSD before they were in the military, and now maybe they're still having PTSD from that, but clearly the PTSD is not from the military. So it gets pretty complicated.
Well, that I think that raises another really, again, complicated issue that some people have talked about and have written about, and they have said, you know, something like this, that some fairly simple screening done before deployment would tell you who is most at risk for PTSD. And maybe then we should say, well, that person should not be sent into combat. The argument is that if we did that, that we could actually significantly reduce the rates of PTSD.
Yeah, I mean, that ideally that would work. The problem is that it is very difficult. We know what kinds of risk factors most predispose someone to developing PTSD, but it doesn't work in 100% of the cases. So you could have two different people who go through the same very horrific trauma. Let's say two different people in the same car in a very horrific car accident where the people in the back seat are killed. The two people in the front, one might develop PTSD and the other doesn't. Just because in addition to things like, you know, how bad the trauma is, people are so diverse that, you know, based on our personalities, our backgrounds, everybody's different in terms of their risk of developing PTSD. So it's very hard to really predict who might be a so-called psychiatric casualty and who wouldn't be in war.
We have some callers. Let's bring some folks who are listening into the conversation. We'll take them in the order they came in, so that means we'll start with line one, and that's someone in Champaign. Right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I wanted to comment on a couple of things. I've had some contact recently with two vets. One was a woman who has been discharged, and the other was a young man who was getting ready to go back for his third tour of duty in about 4 years. And the woman described to me her experience and her difficulty in getting any opportunity to process what was going on when she was in Iraq. And she went to her CO, and he basically said, "Hey, I went through Vietnam, suck it up." And she said her means of coping was to go to her bunk and scream in her pillow for much of the night because it was the only way she could get out the feelings without it affecting, A, her ability to function, and, B, not having that count against her that she was struggling. She had left three children behind, and she also noted that that was an extremely difficult thing for her to do. But for her, you know, she continued to have nightmares when she came back. But as far as I could tell, she was, you know, holding down a job and raising her kids. But I think that the aspect of being separated from her children, as well as not having anyone that she could speak to about it, and it wasn't just the separation, it was what she was seeing on a day-to-day basis that was going on over there. There were no resources for it, at least resources she didn't feel wouldn't come with repercussions for herself on her record and that kind of thing. And with the young man, he seemed very together and very, you know, I mean, he was an awesome soldier, and talking to him was an honor. But when I said something to him about, I don't remember how it was worded, processing, if there was any way to process the things that he'd been going through, he said, "Oh, that I don't even go there. You just put it aside, and that's how you deal with it. You don't deal with it." And so, you know, to me, I found that very distressing for him, because I felt like at some point it was going to raise up and be an issue for him. And I just wondered if you would speak to those two situations.
Sure. Well, thanks for the call. What do you think, Dr. Elhai?
Yeah, I think that your listener is raising a few important issues. One is that, you know, certainly there's still that stigma of PTSD and still that stigma of having mental health problems in the military from the commanding officer who said, you know, just suck it up. I was in Vietnam. I went through a lot, you know, like this or a lot worse. You know, certainly I think the military is a little bit more sensitive to issues of mental health problems now than the military was back in Vietnam. But there are still important barriers that are in place for a soldier who wants to get treatment. And there are some soldiers who claim that if they talk to their officer about having emotional problems, that it's a career ender. They're just not going to be able to go anywhere in their career because they're judged to be weak or whatever. And that's very unfortunate. The other thing that you raised was about the male soldier who was really wanting to avoid at all costs talking about or thinking about the military experience. And that's something that we find, you know, is a very big problem. And, for example, the best treatments that we have for PTSD are treatments where we actually encourage the veteran or the trauma victim to talk about the trauma, to try to get over it. And the more that the person avoids and tries to put it out of their mind at all cost, what we find is that that's just more nightmares that they're having, more flashbacks.
You know, I was really struck by one of the comments that the caller made about the woman who said that when she went to her commanding officer and talked about problems that she was having, that she was just, the guy said, well, I was in Vietnam, so suck it up. Quite a few years ago, I worked on a documentary where I got the chance to sit down and talk with some men, and they were mostly men. There were a couple of women, but mostly men who fought in Vietnam. And they said the same thing. That is, they said when they tried to talk about their experiences in Vietnam with guys who were their dads or their uncles or just older guys who fought in Korea and World War II, that's what they said. They said the same thing. They said, well, I was in Korea. I was in World War II. Just suck it up. They didn't want to hear about these guys talking about their experience in Vietnam.
Yeah.
That gets us around to that question, you know, do we still have a problem in the military that says you, whatever's going on with you, especially if you're having problems, you don't talk about it?
Yeah, there's still that, you know, that culture of silence that I think is characteristic of the military, unfortunately, and not just the military. I mean, you've got, in the civilian communities, you've got people who are attacked and raped, and you know, what's the first thing that people say? It's okay. You don't worry about it. It'll go away. Always with what trauma victims have to deal with, unfortunately, is people just wanting to console them by making them not have to worry about it, not have to think about it. And unfortunately, what we find is that the more silence there is, the worse the person's problems get to be.
We have another caller here. Let's go to line number two, and this is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Uh-huh.
What about in terms of delay? In other words, there doesn't seem to be any signs. There must have been studies, or there have been studies, in other words, years later or not, or isn't too good about following it up. You know, in terms of post-traumatic stress. You know, in other words, let's say they're out, they don't show the signs, or they, you know, in terms of the testing. But what about the delay? You know, 5 years later.
Well, we do have that. We do find that in the literature. We do find cases of people having what we call delayed onset PTSD. More commonly, what we find in the literature is that there's a delay of weeks or months. It's not very common. It's possible, but it's not very common for someone to after a trauma, to be relatively free of any mental health problems, and then years later, all of a sudden, they start having PTSD. But so I guess what I'm saying is that there is a delay that we sometimes find, but it tends not to be a huge delay of many years. But it is possible.
And then second, in terms of, again, where they're sending these troops back again and again without much time in between, or was it at one point where they'd have maybe a year or something or other, you know, especially the National Guard and all that kind of stuff. Have you seen an increase in that regard among the stress?
Well, we do find that in the literature. Research shows that there is a link between, you know, how much how much exposure to trauma someone has and the risk of PTSD. So, of course, it makes sense that someone is going to go through 2, 3, 4 tours, that they're going to just, that's just that much more trauma that they're seeing. That's that much more likely that they'll develop PTSD.
Okay, thanks.
All right. This gets another question. You can tell me whether you think that this is true. One of the things that I had read was that 4 civilians who experienced their traumatic event in civilian life, the likelihood of developing PTSD decreases with time after the traumatic event, but that for soldiers, for American soldiers, the opposite is true. That is, the rates actually increase as time passes after service. Is that true?
Well, we do tend to find in civilians that even with traumas like rape, that over time, even if they had PTSD early on after their trauma, for example, rape, that PTSD usually remits within months. And we tend to find the opposite with combat, if I'm understanding your question.
Yes, that is indeed the question. Well, why should that be?
Yeah, I mean, it mainly seems to have to do with chronicity. You know, if you're in a trauma like rape, you know, it might be a one-time event. With combat, for example, you might be dealing with, you know, if it's a combat veteran, you might be dealing with daily combat patrols, you know, seeing combat trauma on a daily basis. So it just compounds the trauma, it compounds the likelihood of PTSD. So it seems to be a function of whether the trauma is kind of a one-time event thing, which may be less likely to develop PTSD or less likely for PTSD to really be chronic versus, you know, a daily kind of thing. The other type of trauma that we see this in addition to combat, is things like child abuse, where you've got, you know, abuse of a child in a daily manner. That's similar to combat in the sense that the trauma is happening, you know, very often, and it's happening again and again. And for those types of people, we tend to see likelihood of chronic PTSD.
All right. To another caller. This is Effingham, line number 4. Hello.
Thank you, David. Your guest just touched on what I was about to ask. The shame associated with PTSD and showing a masculine deficiency to daddy. And daddy, who fears a homosexual son, will meter out the punishment for misdeeds and such, and that trauma is just what you talked about. And those things start very early in childhood or even in upper infancy, and how that plays out, and then the unwillingness to talk about the PTSD or the trauma of those situations, both civilian and, as you've said, and in the military. But the military is more, I think, gruesome and made into a different venue when military action was governed by looting instead of patriotism. Thanks, Dave, and I'll ring off.
All right. I don't know how you can respond, or you can respond to that any way that you like.
I didn't hear a specific question there, but I think the caller makes some good points about how, yes, certainly there's trauma that unfortunately happens in childhood. One thing that I was thinking of from what the caller was saying is that he said that, you know, military trauma can be very gruesome. The other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, different wars are very different in terms of conditions and climate and all sorts of things. And even within a war, you know, different soldiers might go through very different experiences. So I think this kind of harkens back to what I mentioned before. You could have a Vietnam War veteran who dealt with really serious daily combat patrols, seeing all kinds of really gruesome things that the caller was alluding to. You could also have a Vietnam War veteran who served in a very large military base who had a very different experience of war. So it just kind of demonstrates how diverse the wars can be in terms of what kind of effect it would have on the person.
Our guest in this hour is Dr. John L. High. He's a psychologist who's done a lot of research on psychological trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder. He now serves as assistant professor in the University of Toledo's Department of Psychology. That's in Toledo, Ohio, where he directs their post-traumatic stress disorder lab. And we're talking about PTSD, what it is, what causes it, and also some recent, we started out talking about some recent changes by the VA intended to make it easier for people who have suffered it to get a diagnosis so that they can get help. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You also can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I do want to get back to something that I mentioned glancingly at near the beginning and said I wanted to come back to it, and that is people have raised some questions about rates of PTSD comparing American soldiers to soldiers from other countries. For example, the rates of PTSD among soldiers from the UK are significantly lower than they are for American soldiers, and people have asked why. Why should that be? What's the difference?
Well, you know, each of these, like I was saying before, each of these studies is conducted differently. Some of them, you know, immediately recruit their subjects for the study immediately after they return from combat. Others wait a year or more. So, you know, the measures are different. Some of these studies use actual diagnostic interviews, which is really the best state-of-the-art way to diagnose PTSD. Other of these studies use self-report surveys where you have the veteran basically just filling out a self-report survey of symptoms without an interviewer able to really confirm that the symptoms are severe or frequent enough to warrant being counted as a clinical symptom for a diagnosis. Some of the UK studies, the British studies, find PTSD is as low in veterans as 4%. Well, what we know from large-scale studies of PTSD in the community is that that's even lower than general population rates of PTSD among people who may not have ever been in war. So I don't really have an answer for you. I mean, each study is different. They include different things, and I think all you can do is really take a look at the best. As a scientist, I would take a look at the best studies and try to extract from there, you know, what's the most likely prevalence of PTSD based on the best conducted studies.
So what I hear you saying is that you think that perhaps some of these differences are artifacts related to differences in design of the studies, in the methods that they employ, and that if we could have the studies be more, from one study to another, to be more consistent in the way that they're doing it, then we might not see such big differences.
Right, exactly. And another couple of quick things about that could represent why there's some variety is that, you know, we talked about earlier that it's not just whether you have the symptoms of PTSD that would qualify you for the diagnosis, but whether the symptoms interfere with your everyday life in some important way. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's not assessed in a lot of these studies and could account for lower prevalence rates, or for higher prevalence rates. But, you know, the other thing, too, is it is possible that it's a function of that American veterans have a worse time than some of these other countries' veterans. So we can't dispel that, too. It's a lot of different factors that could play a role.
I think that the reaction to the changes in the rule changes that we talked about, that is trying to make it easier for people to get a diagnosis so that they can get help. I think that a lot of people looked at that and said, well, this is good. That before it was very complicated, that soldiers had to be the ones to prove that it had happened and that the changes are good. Now, at the same time, some people have looked at this and said, well, there's one thing that still kind of concerns them, and that is that the diagnosis still has to be made by a VA doctor. The VA says, well, we think that it's important that the diagnosis is made by a VA doctor because we think that a VA doctor would be better able to determine whether this person who is making the claim of PTSD actually has it or not. That which suggests that the VA is thinking, well, that there are some people who are faking it. And so that kind of gets at a couple of questions. Maybe the one question is, well, what do we know? How many people do you think or do we think are claiming to have PTSD who don't and who know that they don't?
Well, that's very hard to estimate. I mean, we do have some studies showing when we ask people who have not volunteered to get treatment, we ask them about the symptoms of PTSD, we certainly see that some of those veterans do have PTSD, so they wouldn't come forward by saying that they have PTSD, but when we ask them about the symptoms, in fact, that they would meet the full diagnosis. And we do have some literature on the other, you know, from the opposite extreme, where we find when we look at veterans who come to PTSD clinics claiming to have combat-related PTSD, and we go back to their official military records through filing Freedom of Information Act claims with the government, we find a minority of veterans who, in fact, they must have lied about where they were in war to support a PTSD claim. You know, keeping in mind that records are not completely perfect. They can never be. In the war zone, it's very hard to keep 100% accurate records. But we do have some evidence that there are some people who are fabricating trauma or fabricating PTSD. Mm.
And do you think that it is the case that a VA doctor would be better able to determine whether someone was fabricating that than a physician who is in private practice?
Well, certainly what the VA physicians, the VA psychologists and mental health professionals have to their advantage is that they've had the experience of working with PTSD among military veterans. So they have the experience of hearing about veterans' reports of the military and hearing about common symptoms and things like that. So, you know, that's what they have for them. On the other hand, I mean, really, any mental health professional who's trained in accurate diagnosis could do a good job of diagnosing PTSD.
I guess here the concern that some people might have is if the VA physicians have absorbed this ethic that says, if they've absorbed the suck it up ethic, that they might be less tolerant, less inclined to accept someone's story about what they've experienced.
It's possible. I mean, you know, anything's possible. And I think the other thing that you were alluding to, David, is, you know, if these are folks who are working for the VA, then do they have an investment in making sure that they're deflating the number of PTSD
cases? Yes. Well, that kind of allegation has indeed been made.
And, you know, fortunately, in talking to, because I used to work at a VA for 3 years, and as a psychologist, you know, fortunately, it seems to be that, at least at that time, and in talking to people who work at the VA now, that the process of assessing veterans in a claims process is pretty different from working in the treatment clinic, and that I haven't heard of cases where the VA has come down hard on VA doctors for diagnosing people one way or another. I mean, you never know. It's always possible. But it always seems like the VA mental health professionals who I've talked to, that they've claimed to me that they're able to be pretty independent in their diagnosis, but, you know, I mean, you can't be totally for sure.
We have some other callers here. We have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus. We're talking about post-traumatic stress disorder. Our guest is Dr. John L. High. He's professor of psychology at University of Toledo, and he directs the PTSD lab there in their Department of Psychology. We'll go on to some other callers, and I believe our next person is calling from Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Great show. Time is short, so I'll ask a quick question to ring off. Just out of curiosity, I was wondering if the doctor had any data as to the relationship between PTSD and technology. And what I mean by that is, you know, the new military, albeit a very small amount of people, but these perhaps some of the soldiers that operate drones. There was a story on the news, a guy sitting in front of a TV screen for 8 hours a day directing the attack of drones. He happens to be in Arizona. and at the end of the day, he goes home and has dinner with his family. Now, I'm just wondering, would that be an inverse relationship to PTSD, or is there a relationship? Just out of curiosity, I'll ring off. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
I think it's a good question. I don't believe that there's any such data out there about that. I mean, to some extent, the whole idea of the diagnosis of PTSD is that those more connected with the trauma would be more likely to get it, and to some extent that there is evidence to support that. On the other hand, we do have people who witness traumas, and you know, it's possible to be far removed from a trauma, and you know, we just don't really have a whole lot of evidence on this one way or the other. But I think we're going to probably see some evidence at some point, because as the caller's right, we're having more of these drone attacks, and I suspect we'll know eventually some more.
Well, that raises this really interesting question, that could someone like that suffer combat stress? And I guess what you're saying is, well, we really don't know.
Yeah, one of the things that the new proposed criteria for PTSD in the next version of the diagnosis, in the diagnosis and statistical manual of mental disorders, which is supposed to come out in a couple of years, it's interesting. There's something in there that says that whereas in the current version of PTSD, one way to have a trauma happen to you is through witnessing it happening to someone else. In the next version of PTSD that they're proposing is a caveat that witnessing it happen to someone else has to be not through electronic media, not through TV. You know, if you witness the trauma, it has to be interpersonally, you're there. So, but, you know, I could see the drone attack. It's not just witnessing a trauma. It's actually someone who's causing it happen. You could imagine that person could develop PTSD because of the fact that they're actually involved in the conduct of the killing. But it's a complex issue.
All right. To another caller here, someone in Savoy, line one. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a couple of questions. One you've sort of just touched on in terms of diagnosis, and could you discuss the importance of the correct diagnosis, symptomology versus actual PTSD, if you feel you haven't already covered that? And the second thing you may or may not know about, military's preparation of soldiers for war in saying you may experience X and that will be normal, but if you continue to experience X, then you need to see someone, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
All right.
Thank you. I think what your caller's comments deal with are that dimensional nature of PTSD, ranging from, you know, you come back from war and you're having some nightmares for a few weeks and then they go away and then you're fine, to, you know, full-blown PTSD. And so I think we do need to be thinking about the diagnosis more, you know, on a continuum than just whether or not the person has the diagnosis. The military does tell veterans things like, you know, if you get home and you're having symptoms for a few days, that's normal. And, you know, trying to get the veteran to know when it would be problematic enough that it's beyond just kind of a normal response to an abnormal situation, but when it's actually, you know, a diagnosable kind of problem. I don't know how to address that anymore.
And then to the general question, what do we do before we send people into combat? How do we prepare them, or is there any way to prepare them?
Well, there are some. It is difficult to prepare. I mean, to some extent, we do have data that people who are more prepared for a trauma, because they know what's going to happen, they know what they're getting into, that may buffer reactions of PTSD. But even so, you know, oftentimes what we hear soldiers say is that I was prepared for it, I knew what to expect, and then I got there and you know, everything that I learned went completely out the window. It was totally not what I expected. So, you know, preparation is probably good. It probably, if anything, what the preparation does is that it gives the soldier confidence. And that's ideally what, you know, we really need the soldiers to have, to feel like they're going into a situation where they have some control. Mm-hmm. But after that, you know, even with all the preparation in the world, you're still going to have mental health casualties, you're still going to have PTSD. And so after they come back, that's really the only time when when we can best intervene.
We're coming down to a minute or two. I think in an interesting and difficult way, you know, we ask the question, are there people who have PTSD that we are missing or who, for whatever reason, aren't getting treatment or aren't holding up their hands and saying, I'm having a problem? And we have to say the answer is yes. Then if you ask the question, well, are we overdiagnosing? Are there some people we say that have PTSD that don't? Well, maybe the answer to that question is yes, too. So in this very curious way, we might be, in fact, both over and underdiagnosing.
I think that that's true. I suspect that the bigger, the more prevalent thing that's going on is the under-recognition of PTSD. Mm-hmm. I suspect that it's more minority, it's a less prevalent situation of people fabricating it. But I think you're right in your conclusion.
The other thing that really strikes me is that it seems that there's a way in which we talk about PTSD as if it was an abnormal response, when the fact is that it's actually a very normal response to a hugely stressful experience.
It's a normal response, but I think when we say it's abnormal is when it so overwhelms the person that they just can't get along with their everyday life, and when it goes on for months, that's when we start calling it a mental disorder. So it's really a normal response to an abnormal event, but it can really overpower the person, and then it becomes abnormal.
And though still you have to, it seems as if it's a very individual thing, what the experience is from person to person, how it is they're going to be affected, and then what sort of help that they might need afterwards.
That's true. That's very much true. And on the continuum of treatment, some veterans might be totally fine with a few sessions of mental health treatment, and then they're fine. Others might really benefit from months or more than a year of treatment.
Overall, how are we doing, do you think?
I think that we're doing pretty well and getting better in the diagnosis as we have more and better instruments out there to help diagnose PTSD. In the treatment, I think we're getting better, and I think the VA is getting better because we are finally starting to roll out in the VA the most state-of-the-art evidence-based treatments for PTSD. So-called exposure therapies, and that's starting to finally happen.
All right. Our guest, Dr. John L. High, he is Assistant Professor of Psychology at the University of Toledo in Toledo, Ohio. Professor L. High, thanks very much.
My pleasure.